Hi, I'm Beth.
And I'm Jimmy.
And we're the Talk to the Hand podcast.
Hello, Beth.
Hello, Jimmy. How are you?
I'm really good. Really good, actually. How are you doing?
Yeah, I'm up for this today because it's miserable outside. We can hear the rain and the cars going past and we're all nice and cosy with our listeners doing this podcast.
And we've got our daughter sitting reading on the couch and we've got our son who's just gone on to his PlayStation. So that should give us enough time to get through the podcast without interruption.
Yes, yeah, all good stuff.
We have a massive story today.
We do. It was so massive at the time, wasn't it? And our listeners will remember, I'm sure, the shock that they had when this story came out. Disbelief.
I'm sure they will. It was so big. It is one of the stories of the 90s.
Yes, it is.
So today, Beth, we're going to be talking about
O.J. Simpson.
Wow, what a story. We're going to run through this now on the podcast for you. We really hope you enjoy the episode. But for now,
rewind to the 90s.
Orenthal James Simpson was born on July the 9th, 1947 in San Francisco, California. His mum was Eunice, who was a hospital administrator, and his father was Jimmy Lee Simpson. Now, he'd been an employee of the Federal Reserve Bank and a one-time bank custodian. Jimmy Lee Simpson was also a well-known drag queen in the San Francisco Bay Area. He later announced that he was gay. I had no idea about that.
No idea whatsoever. Orenthal James Simpson was called OJ from an early age and did not know that Orenthal was his given name until a teacher read it out in third grade.
So he was called OJ so often he didn't know that wasn't his name.
He had one brother and two sisters and his parents separated in 1952, and Simpson was raised by his mother Eunice in the rugged, largely black Barretto Hill district of San Francisco.
At the age of two, he contracted rickets, leaving his legs skinny, bow-legged and pigeon-toed. Because his mum couldn't afford braces, she made him wear a pair of shoes connected by an iron bar for a few hours almost every day until he was five. Simpson was a problem child. When he was 13, he joined a street gang called the Persian Warriors. He says, "I never infringed on people. I only beat up dudes who deserved it, at least once a week, usually on a Friday or Saturday night. If there weren't no fight, it wasn't no weekend." One of his fights landed the then 15-year-old high school sophomore in a youth guidance centre. And after his third arrest, he actually met baseball star Willie Mays. And during that conversation, Mays encouraged Simpson to avoid getting into trouble. And this marked a big change in his life. While Simpson excelled as an all-city football player at Galileo, his high school grades, which were less than stellar, hindered his chances of garnering attention from college recruiters, opting to sidestep military service after a childhood friend's Vietnam War injury left a lasting impact on him. Simpson enrolled at City College of San Francisco in 1965. Displaying his versatility, he played as both a running back and a defensive back, earning a spot on the junior college All-American team as a running back after City College's victory in the Prune Bowl against Long Beach State.
With multiple colleges now vying for Simpson as a transfer student, he ultimately selected the University of Southern California, joining the Trojans under the guidance of head coach John McKay in 1967 and 1968. Simpson dominated the rushing game nationally, securing the top spot in 1967 with 1,543 yards and 13 touchdowns, and repeating the feat in 1968 with 1,880 yards on 383 carries.
You know, to someone, that's going to mean a lot more than it does to us.
Yes, yes.
In his junior year, Simpson narrowly missed the Heisman Trophy. Oh, I know what the Heisman Trophy is, because I've watched some of the documentaries on Netflix where they tell the story of maybe an American footballer who had it all ahead of him, who was going to be this big star. And when they're coming through from college football, they award the Heisman Trophy to one of them.
Oh, okay.
And in a couple of occasions, it never worked out that well for them. But yeah, I'm aware of that one.
Okay.
So he finished as a runner-up to UCLA quarterback Gary Beeman. In a pivotal game against their rivals, a stunning 64-yard touchdown run by Simpson tied the score and contributing to a 21-20 victory in the fourth quarter. And this iconic play remains a defining moment in one of the 20th century's greatest football games. Now, Simpson's athletic prowess extended beyond football. He was an aspiring track athlete who'd previously raced against British record holder Menzie Campbell in 1967. Before gracing the football field at USC, he was part of the sprint relay quartet that broke the world record in the 4x110-yard relay at the NCAA Track Championships in Utah in 1967.
So from someone who, as a child, had to wear an iron bar because of rickets and everything, he's done a lot fitness-wise, hasn't he?
Maybe the iron bar was a good move by his mum.
Maybe. On June the 24th, 1967, at the age of just 19, Simpson married Marguerite L. Whiteley. The couple met in San Francisco when the two were in high school, and they went on to have three children.
In his senior year in 1968, Simpson's remarkable performance saw him rush for 1,709 yards and 22 touchdowns in the regular season, culminating in him winning the Heisman Trophy, the Maxwell Award, and the Walter Camp Award. Selected as the first pick in the 1969 draft, Simpson's initial 3 years with the Buffalo Bills proved frustrating, with head coaches not wanting to build the offense around him. It wasn't until Lou Saban assumed control in 1972 that Simpson's true potential became evident.
In 1972, Simpson led the NFL in rushing with 1,251 yards, setting the stage for an even more remarkable performance in 1973.
Following a season hampered by injuries in 1974, he rebounded in 75 with an outstanding performance, with lots of yards and lots of touchdowns. The following season, he secured his rushing title with another lot of yards. Injuries plagued him in 1977 and limited him to just 7 games before he was traded to the San Francisco 49ers. The investment proved costly as Simpson failed to live up to expectations, gaining a lot of yards but not as many yards, and averaging less than 4 yards per carry in his concluding 2 NFL seasons.
Simpson met Nicole Brown in 1977 while she was working as a waitress at a nightclub called The Daisy. Although still married to his first wife, Simpson began dating Brown. Simpson and Marguerite divorced in March 1979.
Tragically, it was not long after the divorce when their daughter, Aaron, accidentally fell into a swimming pool and her family found her motionless soon after. She was unresponsive when paramedics arrived and she fell into a coma, and on August the 26th, 1979, she passed away due to respiratory failure just a few days before her second birthday.
That's so sad.
Oh, that is so tragic.
Oh my gosh.
I mean, it doesn't bear thinking about. Upon retiring from the sport, Simpson ventured into acting, featuring in productions like Cassandra Crossing, The Towering Inferno, and The Naked Gun Trilogy.
Which is where I knew who he was. I didn't really know about his sporting background at the time. It was the Naked Gun films.
I have to say, it was the same for me. And I remember them talking about him, that he's a big American football star, but I hadn't known him as that.
No.
Additionally, Simpson transitioned into sports casting. While football had been a natural talent for him, broadcasting posed a challenge, with criticisms directed at his perceived inarticulateness. Nevertheless, his infectious personality endeared him to viewers, maintaining his popularity despite the criticism. So Nicole and Simpson were married on February the 2nd, 1985, 5 years after his retirement from professional football, and a year before his father passed away, having contracted AIDS. Mm.
So Brown and Simpson had 2 children. However, in 1989, OJ was charged with beating Nicole Brown. He hit and kicked her as he yelled, "I'll kill you." Records show that Simpson beat his wife so badly that she needed hospital treatment. Simpson told reporting officers, "The police have been out here 8 times before and now they're going to arrest me for this." He was placed on 2 years probation, ordered to undergo psychiatric counselling and perform community service after pleading no contest.
Now, Brown filed for divorce on February the 25th, 92, citing irreconcilable differences. They tried to get back together again a year later, but it was just destined not to work. And what you were saying about the attack and his nonchalant response to the police who came to arrest him, that paints a picture of the kind of man we're talking about.
Yeah, very different to the man that we remember on The Naked Gun. Very different to that lifestyle as well.
So on June the 12th, 94, a gruesome crime unfolded at the residence of O.J. Simpson's ex-wife, Nicole Brown, and restaurant waiter Ronald Goldman in Bundy Drive, Brentwood, Los Angeles. The Simpson children were still asleep in their rooms when their mother's lifeless body was discovered just after midnight by a neighbour walking his dog. The neighbour found Brown's dog barking at her body sprawled across the front porch steps, with Goldman lying several feet away in the shrubbery. The police were promptly contacted and arrived at the scene at around 1 a.m.
The primary cause of death is believed to be the sharp force injuries. The signs of a struggle were confirmed by the police. However, there was no evidence suggesting a robbery. Crime scene evidence included a blood-stained glove, seemingly left by the suspected killer, a knitted hat and a bloody footprint. After identifying the bodies, the police went to OJ's residence in Brentwood to inform him of the tragic death of the mother of his children, unaware that he would soon become a suspect.
That is bizarre though, isn't it? Bizarre. With everything we know now.
Yeah.
The authorities reached Simpson's property, located just 2 miles from the crime scene, and attempted to contact him by ringing the gate, and they received no response. During this time, they discovered small yet significant bloodstains on Simpson's well-known white Ford Bronco. Upon observing the blood, Detective Mark Furman vaulted over the security gate into the estate and approached the front door. Once within the premises, the detectives roused OJ's daughter, Arnell, who was residing in a guest house. She guided the detectives inside, where they contacted Simpson's assistant. Detective Venata then officially declared the property a crime scene and initiated the process of obtaining a warrant to search the house. Now, after determining that Simpson was not present at his estate, the police sought information on the time of his departure from Brentwood, and this was really to try and ascertain his potential involvement. The exact timing of OJ's trip to Chicago remains somewhat unclear. Simpson's lawyer at the time mentioned that his client had taken a flight somewhere late evening on Sunday. Detectives Furman and Venata reached out to the O'Hare Plaza Hotel, situated near Chicago's O'Hare Airport, where the general manager indicated that the football star had checked in at 6:15 in the morning of June the 13th, Chicago time. This suggested that Simpson might have taken at least one of 3 flights departing LA after 11:30 p.m. Pacific time on Sunday.
The Los Angeles police contacted Simpson later that morning to inform him of his ex-wife's death. Vanetta reported Simpson's response as unusual. Instead of inquiring about the manner of Nicole's death, Simpson simply asked who killed her. The LAPD considered this reaction as another piece of evidence implicating Simpson as a person of interest.
That is a strange response to the mother of your children and your ex-wife being murdered.
Yes.
There'd be a grieving process first, surely. There'd be a shock.
Yeah.
On that evening, Simpson returned from Chicago on the next available flight. Shortly after his arrival at his lavish home in Brentwood, the police arrived at his residence. By this time, the media had already surrounded Simpson's Rockingham estate. When confronted by the police, Simpson took the detectives into his garden away from the press. There, he was briefly handcuffed before his attorney intervened, emphasising Simpson's widespread reputation as a respected football star and argued against portraying him as a villain in such a delicate situation, as he was not yet a suspect. Subsequently, he was uncuffed and taken away for 3 hours of questioning, with no arrest made. Unfortunately, a reporter from CNN had managed to breach Simpson's garden and capture a photo of him in handcuffs, which was later published in an article that day, revealing to the world that the beloved O.J. Simpson was a person of interest in the case.
The following day, news reports indicated that the bloodstains found on Simpson's vehicle and driveway matched those discovered at the crime scene. Rumours then circulated that Simpson had a glove in his residence matching the one found at the murder scene. This prompted Wiseman to withdraw from his position as Simpson's attorney, citing his close and personal friendship with the client. Robert Shapiro, a high-profile lawyer accustomed to living in the public eye and deeply concerned with his media appearance, officially addressed the press, stating, "At the time that this murder took place, OJ was at home waiting to get into a limousine to take him to the airport on a trip that had been planned well in advance for a promotional event in Chicago." Police had yet to confirm whether Simpson was a suspect.
Within 2 days, the football star was charged with 2 counts of murder. Shapiro received a call from LAPD officials instructing him to surrender. Shapiro went to Robert Kardashian's house, a close friend of Simpson, to inform that OJ must turn himself in by 11 a.m. However, OJ failed to appear by the specified time. Shapiro received another call from the LAPD stating that they had to announce Simpson as a fugitive. Upon hearing this, Shapiro provided the police with directions to Kardashian's San Fernando Valley house where they could arrest OJ in privacy. The authorities arrive at the residence and proceed upstairs to apprehend Simpson, while Shapiro, Kardashian and Simpson's family members remain downstairs. The officers swiftly return downstairs without OJ, informing everyone that he's not present, causing widespread panic. Upon a hurried check outside, it's disclosed that Al Cowlings, a former college and pro football teammate of Simpson who'd been with the family, has left the house. LAPD Commodore David Gascon announces that Simpson had failed to surrender for the scheduled arraignment and is now considered a fugitive. District Attorney Gil Garcetta adds, during a separate press conference, that anyone aiding Simpson in evading capture will be prosecuted as a felon, declaring, "We will find Mr. Simpson and bring him to justice." Consequently, the police issued an arrest warrant for Cowlands.
Later that evening, with no sign of Simpson, Shapiro conducts his own press conference, during which Kardashian reads a purported suicide letter from Simpson. "Don't feel sorry for me," the note concludes. "I've had a great life, great friends. Please think of the real OJ and not this lost person. Thanks for making my life special. I hope I helped yours. Peace and love, OJ."
Shortly after, Simpson allegedly makes a 911 call from a cellular phone in Cowlands' Ford Bronco. The authorities trace his location to Santa Ana Freeway in Orange County, near where Nicole had been buried the previous Thursday. The California Highway Patrol initiated a pursuit. So Cowlings remained on the phone with the police for the majority of the chase, repeatedly stating that Simpson is seated in the back of the vehicle with a gun to his head, clutching a photo of his children. Cowling reported that Simpson was expressing that all he ever had done was love Nicole and that he wants to be taken to his mother. The chase progressed into the early evening and encountered crowds standing on the roadway and overpasses. Within an hour, Simpson and Cowlings arrived at the Brentwood estate where SWAT teams lied in wait in anticipation of Simpson's arrival. He exited the car without resistance, received a phone call from his mother, and then initiated negotiations for his surrender. Subsequently, he was arrested and taken into police custody where he was jailed without bail. So this was that slow speed pursuit that I remember so vividly. And it was all captured on camera, broadcast on television.
Yeah.
And it took center stage across all the television networks, with cable news channels dedicating 2 hours of uninterrupted coverage of the event. And it's regarded as one of the most unforgettable moments in television history. Major sports channels shifted their focus from prominent sports competitions such as the NBA Finals, the US Open and the World Cup opening to provide continuous coverage of the chase on smaller screens. Not only did the television industry witness record-breaking viewership, but Domino's Pizza experienced a surge in sales, setting new delivery records by the chase. So people were watching it and wanting pizza
ordering their food,
too.
Yeah. On June 20th, 94, Simpson appeared before the court, entering a plea of not guilty to both murder charges. The subsequent day saw the convening of the grand jury, a panel of diverse citizens tasked with deciding whether to indict him or not. Just 2 days later, the grand jury was disbanded due to overwhelming media coverage, which raised concerns about potential juror bias.
It's so difficult when you're talking about someone with this level of fame, because anything anyone hears is going to risk bias one way or the other.
Yeah, and the shocking circumstances, his murder of his wife.
So the trial commenced in January 95. The Los Angeles District Attorney's Office centered their case on the history of domestic violence in Simpson and Brown's relationship, both before and after their divorce. Darden kicked off the trial with opening statements portraying Simpson as an abusive husband and suggested this is the motive for the murders. They presented a 911 call where Nicole expressed fear that Simpson would kill her, along with witnesses including Nicole's sister, who testified to instances of abuse, and an individual who found Brown in distress, echoing the sentiments of the 911 call. And despite the seemingly compelling evidence against Simpson, he sought the aid of five of the nation's most skilled and expensive lawyers, controversially referred to as the Dream Team, comprising F. Lee Bailey, Robert Blasier, Sean Chapman Holly, Robert Shapiro, and Alan Dershowitz. The team was later joined by Johnny Cochran, who became the lead attorney. Simpson's defense primarily revolved around claims of mishandled evidence, notably challenging the authenticity of the black leather glove found at the crime scene. The defense argued that the detective, Mark Furman, planted the glove to frame Simpson. They further demonstrated that the glove was too small for Simpson, having him try it on in front of the jury. The defense also spotlighted instances of racial bias within the LAPD, presented a tape in which Furman made highly offensive remarks against African Americans, a significant factor in the racial composition of the jury.
The trial endured for 8 arduous months, concluding in October. What initially seemed like a straightforward murder case had transformed into a narrative of racial tensions. On October the 2nd, 94, the jury was sequestered to reach a verdict, which remarkably took less than 4 hours, prompting concerns from both sides. Judge Ito deferred the announcement to the following day. On the 3rd of October, O.J. Simpson was declared not guilty of murdering Nicole Brown Simpson and Ronald Goldman. The verdict, witnessed by over 150 million people worldwide, elicited divergent reactions along racial lines, White individuals expressed confusion and dismay, feeling that Nicole and Ronald deserved justice, while black individuals viewed Simpson's acquittal as a triumph of African Americans in the face of historic legal discrimination.
And race played a massive part in the case, and indeed in OJ's life. So during the highs of his career, he garnered widespread admiration from the white American population. His exceptional football achievements, his commercials, and the comedic role he had in Naked Gun contributed to that immense popularity. O.J. Simpson seemed to be living the perfect life, successfully evading the racial profiling that afflicted many of his black friends and family. Freed from the racial challenges he once faced, Simpson consistently declined opportunities to actively support black America. A memorable quote, "I'm not black, I'm O.J.," emerged from an interview with civil rights leader Harry Edwards, who urged Simpson to participate in protests against social inequalities. Simpson's recurrent refusals to engage with such issues led to his diminished popularity among fellow black figures of the era. Despite Simpson's efforts to integrate into white society rather than align with the black community, when he faced trial, white individuals began to distance themselves from him. And a real strong example is the infamous incident where the New York Times newspaper altered his skin tone on the front cover of the tabloid. Speculation arose that this adjustment was an attempt to sway public opinion towards his guilt, with the argument that darkening the photo played into America's preconceived notions about darker-skinned individuals. The dynamics of Simpson's association with either race highlighted that achieving superstar status could momentarily shield one from America's racial tensions. However, once under suspicion of wrongdoing, it became easy to be drawn back into the discourse on race.
After the case was all over with, and Simpson, although found not guilty, had been left with little to his name, he had also realised that his rejection of black solidarity had finally caught up with him. His white audience were no longer interested in someone they believed that killed his wife, and he had alienated himself from his black lifestyle for so long that black people didn't want to associate with him either.
And I think that's the important thing. Although black people were largely celebrating the verdict that was given on OJ, it wasn't because they had great love for OJ. It was because of the fact that black people had often been treated very badly in the American legal system and in courts. Yeah. So they were celebrating a victory for a black representative of their community rather than for OJ Simpson himself. Yeah. After Simpson's acquittal on criminal charges, the families of Ron Goldman and Nicole Brown Simpson pursued a civil lawsuit against him. In February 97, a civil jury in Santa Monica, California, unanimously found Simpson responsible for the wrongful death of and battery against Goldman, along with battery against Brown, although the Brown family did not file a wrongful death claim. Simpson was directed to pay $33.5 million in damages, $8.5 million in compensatory damages to the Goldman family, and $12.5 million in punitive damages to each family. In February 99, an auction of Simpson's Heisman Trophy and other belongings generated nearly $500,000, all of which went to the Goldman family. And Beth, please remember this auction for later in the story.
Yeah.
Okay? Because this comes back as an important part of later in the story of OJ. Yeah.
In 97, Simpson defaulted on his mortgage at the home in which he'd lived for 20 years and was evicted.
On January the 4th, 2007, a federal judge issued a restraining order preventing Simpson from spending any advance he might have received for a cancelled book deal and TV interview regarding the 94 murders. The case was dismissed before trial due to a lack of jurisdiction. On January the 19th, 2007, a California state judge issued an additional restraining order instructing Simpson to limit his expenditures to ordinary and necessary living expenses. On March the 13th, 2007, a judge barred Simpson from receiving any further compensation related to the abandoned book deal and TV interview. The judge further directed the auction of the bundled book rights. In August 2007, a Florida bankruptcy court granted the book rights to the Goldman family, serving as partial satisfaction for an outstanding civil judgment. Originally titled If I Did It, the book underwent a name change to If I Did It, Confessions of a Killer. The alteration featured the word if minimized to fit within the prominent red I in the title, creating the appearance of I Did It, Confessions of the Killer. Supplementary content was contributed by members of the Goldman family and others. So what's happened here is OJ's written a book. The family of Ron Goldman had won the rights to the book to settle the money he owed them from the civil case.
Yeah.
And they've taken his book and changed the title to be much more apparently incriminating.
Yeah. In February 2001, Simpson was arrested in Miami County, Florida, for yanking the glasses off another motorist during a traffic dispute 3 months earlier. If convicted, Simpson could face up to 16 years in prison, but he was tried and quickly acquitted of both charges.
On December the 4th, 2001, the FBI conducted a search of Simpson's residence in Miami based on suspicions of ecstasy possession and money laundering. And this action was prompted by a tip suggesting Simpson's involvement in a significant drug trafficking ring following the arrest of 10 other suspects in the case. Despite a thorough two-hour search, no illegal drugs were found and no formal charges were pressed. However, investigators discovered equipment capable of pirating satellite television programming, leading to a subsequent federal lawsuit against Simpson. On July the 4th, 2002, Simpson faced arrest in Florida for speeding through a manatee protection zone and violating boating regulations. The charges were dropped and Simpson received a fine for the speeding violation. In March 2004, DirecTV Inc. filed a lawsuit against Simpson in a Miami federal court, accusing him of utilizing illegal electronic devices to pirate their broadcast signals. The company ultimately secured a $25,000 judgment and Simpson was ordered to pay an additional $33,678 in attorney's fees and costs. So it's all going wrong for Simpson at this point.
It's coming down. OJ's luck ran out in 2007. He was in Las Vegas to be best man at the wedding of one of his few remaining friends, Thomas Scotto. Simpson had learnt from Tom Biccio, the co-owner of the auction house Universal Rarities, that some of his lost sports memorabilia was also in Vegas. Biccio told him two memorabilia dealers were claiming to have some of his old items. Is this what you were talking about, Jimmy?
It might well be, Beth.
So OJ didn't consider the items to be memorabilia, but instead thought they were his personal items. Well, some of those items were involved.
So OJ got a few friends together to pose as potential buyers of the memorabilia and set up a meeting. OJ and his friends went to the room and two of the group were carrying guns. They burst into the room and started to take the items, along with other completely unrelated items of value. What Simpson didn't know is that one of his group spent a lot of time covertly recording conversations. After a few drinks later, OJ was again recorded and can be heard saying it was a strong arm robbery. He told the group not to mention that they were armed. Simpson was questioned by police and admitted to taking the items, which he said had been stolen from him, but denied breaking into the hotel room, and he also denied that he or anyone else carried a gun. 2 days later, he was arrested and subsequently charged with multiple felony counts, including criminal conspiracy, kidnapping, assault, robbery, and using a deadly weapon. While on bail, OJ was taken into custody for violating the terms of his bail by attempting to contact a co-defendant in the trial. Simpson and his co-defendant were found guilty of all charges on October the 3rd, 2008. On December the 5th, 2008, Simpson was sentenced to a total of 33 years in prison, with the possibility of parole after 9 years. He appealed, but that appeal was overruled.
So he eventually got a prison sentence for robbery?
Correct. These items that were in the room,
yeah,
most of them seem to have come from that auction. So in his view, they'd been taken off him and were his. The auction house had paid money for these to resell them. So essentially, he took what was now their property.
Yeah.
And there was lots of controversy here because they did have guns. There was questions over whether they showed the guns. Apparently they did.
Okay.
But the people that he'd been working with on this, some of them didn't sing along the same hymn sheet as OJ did.
No.
So in 2017, he was eventually released with parole conditions such as travel restrictions, non-contact with co-defendants from the robbery, and not drinking excessively. He was released on October the 1st, 2017, having served almost 9 years. In December 21, Simpson was released from parole early for good behaviour, releasing him from the previous conditions of his release and effectively making him a completely free man once more.
After being released from prison in 2017, Simpson reportedly resided within a gated community in Las Vegas. His social media presence indicates that he enjoys playing golf and using Twitter to give his opinions on sports and politics.
I think I know what I think he can do with those opinions.
Yes.
So now 76 years old, OJ is occasionally seen in newspapers having been snapped, collecting groceries or walking down the street, and Beth, I have seen him and he looks very frail and he walks with a hunchback and a limp and he's nearly 80.
Yeah.
It's a different OJ than it once was.
Yes.
So as we bring this podcast episode to a close, the life of O.J. Simpson remains a complex and controversial narrative that transcends the boundaries of sports, celebrity and the legal system. From his meteoric rise as a football legend to his fall from grace in the infamous murder trial, Simpson's life has been a story of triumphs and tragedies. The trial of the century, as it was famously dubbed, not only divided a nation along racial lines, but also highlighted flaws within the justice system. Simpson's acquittal in 1995 sparked heated debates and exposed deep-rooted issues of race, privilege, and media sensationalism. The aftermath of the trial saw Simpson navigating a tumultuous path, grappling with legal troubles and public scrutiny that forever altered his once gilded image.
And that's the story of O.J. Simpson.
What a story that is.
What a story. One thing that I think, so, you know, he was acquitted.
Yes.
Right, of the murder.
Yes.
Right. Who did murder her?
The police believe O.J. Simpson.
So they haven't pursued anybody else.
They haven't pursued anybody else. The families took the case to a civil court. Yes. Now, the thing with the civil court, it's not, you're not penalised legally with legal consequences of prison time.
Yeah.
But there is a lower burden of proof. But I do believe he did commit those murders.
Yeah.
And I think when the police managed to get him on the robbery, I can imagine there was an awful lot of backslapping going on during that time. We finally got him. Even if it was for
a minimal amount of time.
Yeah. So it's really, really difficult because we are talking about somebody, and I'll say, who is potentially a murderer and wasn't convicted as such in a court of law, but was convicted in a civil case. Whether or not you believe that Simpson was responsible for the murder, we do know as fact that he was an abusive husband to Nicole Brown. So even for that alone, it justifies the actions they've taken, let alone the potential scenario where he is the murderer.
Yes. Yeah.
Thank you, Beth. That was a really good episode. I hope everyone enjoyed listening to it. Please do come back to us next week when we'll have another 90s recollection episode for you. Until then, talk to the hand.